episode 79 of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and I'm here all by myself right now. My co-host Perry is on the way overseas at the moment, heading off for the World Science Fiction Convention being held in Chicago. However, you'll be hearing from Perry later in this episode in a segment we recorded before he left. So let's get started with some news. In fact, we're starting with a bit of sad news. Alexei Panshin, the author and prominent SF critic, has died at the age of 82. His novel Rite of Passage won the Nebula Award in 1969 and was nominated for Best Novel in the Hugos. He acknowledged that his wife Corey was an unnamed co-writer on some of his stories, and he also collaborated with her on a number of critical works. More details on this are available in Locus magazine, which I'll put a link in the show notes to that. Given that this episode is focusing on the crime genre, it's appropriate that I'm now able to announce the winners of this year's Ned Kelly Awards, which were announced last Wednesday night. There were 135 entries in total for the four categories of the awards, indicating another strong year of Australian and international crime writing. So the winner of the Ned Kelly Award for Best Crime Fiction was The Chase by Candice Fox. We talked about The Chase in episode 55 of this podcast, if you want to check out what we had to say. I think I would say it was definitely a worthy winner. The Best True Crime Award went to Banquet, The Untold Story of Adelaide's Family Murders by Debbie Marshall. Don't know much about that. The Best Debut Crime Novel went to Benjawan by Josh Kemp, which I must try and track down. I think my local library will get a copy, so I'll go hunt that up. And Best International Crime Fiction went to The Maid by Nita Prose, which I haven't read, but it also looks very interesting, and I should follow up on trying to get hold of a copy of that. Moving on from the Ned Kellys, but still in the crime genre, Sisters in Crime Australia have also recently released the shortlist for the Davitt Awards, which go to female authors of crime fiction in Australia. I say shortlist, but there are 11 entries in the Best Novel category, which is pretty long, I reckon. There are several categories, but I'll just quickly go down the list of adult crime novels on the list. We have Sarah Barry, Unforgiven, Jacqueline Bublitz, Before You Knew My Name, B.M. Carroll, You Had It Coming, Tanya Chandler, All That I Remember About Dean Kohler, Jennifer Down, Bodies of Light, which is pretty interesting since that won the Miles Franklin Award recently. I didn't realise they had a crime element. Catherine Jinks, Shelter. Vanessa McCausland, The Beautiful Words. Charlotte McConaughey, Once There Were Wolves. Deborah Oswald, The Family Doctor. Lorraine Peck, The Second Son. And Lynn Ewart, The Silent Listener. Now, it's interesting that there's no overlap with the Ned Kelly Awards that I can see there. There we go. So it'll be interesting to see the result when that is finally announced. And that's really it for the general news. So we'll move on. And here's the segment I recorded earlier with Perry Middlemiss before he left for his overseas trip. And we're talking about crime. How are you, Perry? How's the planning going?
Pretty good, thanks. We're down, as we speak, just a touch over a week before I head off. So the vast bulk of everything's been done. It's now just the minor little bits just to make sure that all the paperwork's in place and that I've got access to it all and I know where it all is. So that's the major thing, because you've got to keep proving all the time that... you know, wherever you are, that you're vaccinated, which of course we are. We've now had our fourth booster, so we've had another one since our previous talk, David. So I'm up to number four now. We're feeling sort of like an Energizer bunny, you know, all ready to roll.
Well, we'll see.
And having had COVID and had four injections, I think that I've got more antibodies in me than I probably am going to need, but... Hopefully, but all you can do is keep your fingers crossed and just take precautions when we're there. And as we were saying off air, the convention that I'm going to, the Worldcon, will have it has a full mask policy that you can only stay on the premises if you're fully masked and fully vaccinated. other than when you're actively eating or drinking. So that will be good. Our problem is going to be when we leave the venue and go somewhere else. That's when we might actually run into a few problems, but we shall keep our fingers crossed. But at this stage, we're hopeful but cautious. How about that?
Oh, I hope it all goes very well for you.
Thank you very much. It's going to be it's going to be interesting. It's going to be quite a long trip too. So, but we haven't been away anywhere, of course, for majorly for 3 years. So that's why we're sort of going for an extra little jaunt this time, and we'll be back in early October.
All right. Mm. Well, until then, let's roll on to the main subject of our podcast today, when we're going to be going to talk about crime again. So do you want to lead off? I think you've got something that you want to start.
Yes, I do. Today's episode isn't necessarily going to be just about crime novels. We will be talking about sort of crime fiction in all its various sort of forms. And my first one is certainly one that is going to be it isn't a crime novel. It's a non-fiction treatment, and I'll explain what it's all about in just a minute. But the year 2020, David, is a quite... 2022, rather. God, I'm forgetting where I am. The year 2022 is quite an auspicious year in terms of crime fiction movies.
Ah.
Are you aware of what this is the 50th anniversary of?
I'm not, but I imagine you're going to tell me it's The Godfather.
Oh, yeah, it is The Godfather. And my view, one of the greatest crime novels ever made, and possibly also one of the greatest novels, greatest films ever made. It's one of my all-time favourites. So what I'm about to say to you could be slightly coming from a slightly biased perspective, but there we go. The book I want to talk about here is a book called Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli, by Mark Seal. And those people who are fans of this particular film will understand that that title is a phrase that comes directly from the film. After a particular character is shot in a car, one of the members of the Don Corleone's family says, well, leave the gun and take the cannoli, because his wife had sent him out to buy some cannoli to bring home, and he didn't want to leave that behind because he's going to get in trouble with his wife. And oddly enough, that line, like a few of the others in this particular film, was ad-libbed by that particular actor. And Coppola liked it so much, the film director, Francis Ford Coppola, liked it so much that he kept it in. But anyway, this is a very interesting look at how that particular film came to be made. And it starts off right back with the original author, Mario Puzo, while he was attempting to write the original novel, The Godfather, which came out in about 1968 or thereabouts. Now, Puzo he'd written a couple of books prior to The Godfather, but he really wasn't well known. But he had this idea about what he wanted to write about, and he was just really trying to work his way through to get it out, get it done. And the agents were helping him out by paying him some money to keep him going. But he was completely anxious all the time, and he was gambling too much and spending too much, drinking too much. But he finally ended up getting through, and the book became a big blockbuster bestseller when it first came out. And in fact, there's a number of crime novel lists that would list all the best crime novels ever written, and The Godfather is on quite a lot of those. I've actually never read the book, I've realised. I came to realise this the other day, and I thought, oh, that's a bit lacking. I really should go back and have a look at it. I think I've read bits and pieces of it, but I haven't read the whole thing. There's a bit of a problem always I have when I really like a film. Do I go back and read the original material? Or if I really like the novel, do I watch the film version of it? I think we spoke about this once when I spoke about French Lieutenant's Woman, and I just refused to go and see the film adaptation of that because it's my all-time favourite novel. I have my view of that particular story in my head. I don't want somebody else's coming in and putting something in over the top. I know for a lot of people that sounds totally ridiculous,
No, but no.
That's just the way I feel about it. In this instance, I really like the film, and I think the film is strong enough that it is going to carry over if I do go back and read the book. So I'll do that in some stage. But anyway, getting back to this particular book, this sort of starts off, works its way through, all the way through with the original writing and publication of the novel. And then, of course, because it did so well, a number of studios were jumping around all over the place trying to find it. But somebody at Paramount Pictures had already seen the original manuscript and pretty much bought it before it was published, before it got the hoopla. And they actually thought they were going to be making a straight gangster movie. Paramount Pictures at that stage was in trouble. They didn't want to spend very much money. They wanted to do a straight adaptation of this particular novel and sort of emphasise the gory bits, if you like, just to try and make it sort of a salacious summer film that a lot of people would go along and have a look at. But as I said, they didn't want to spend very much money. Somebody or other had decided that Francis Ford Coppola, however you want to pronounce it, was probably a good bet because, firstly, he was Italian and it's an Italian story. So they thought that he would be able to work his way through with a number of the Italian actors that they were going to have to use. But you've got to remember that this film was made in the late 1960s. Coppola was born in 1939. He was about 30 when he first started working on this. And he had directed a few films prior to this particular film starting, and his main claim to fame was that he was the co-writer of the screenplay for the George C. Scott film Patton, which won an Academy Award for Best Screenplay. And oddly enough, I was just reading about this morning that Coppola, had written the screenplay, they had bought it for Patton, and they fired him. They decided they didn't like his particular screenplay, and even though they had Patton on board, they were going to get somebody else to write a new screenplay. That new screenplay came in. Scott read it and said, "Nah, he wanted the original one." So unless they took Coppola's original, he wasn't in it.
Okay.
And so it's got that, if you remember, that big iconic scene at the beginning of Patton where he walks up from behind a set of stairs up onto a riser with a ginormous American flag standing behind him. And then he starts pontificating to the troops that are there out in front of him. You think about that scene, and then you think about the very first scene in The Godfather. I don't know whether you remember it, but it's basically a man sitting in a chair in a darkened room, and the camera slowly pulling back away from him, and he gets lighter and lighter, and you can just see him, and he's talking to somebody. And his first line is, "I believe in America." And then he tells his story about how he's come from Italy to America. He set up his business. He's done really very, very well. And then a couple of his daughter's grown up, and then a couple of young guys have come in and taken advantage of her when she was drunk. And as it pulls back, it gets back to, you see the shot over the shoulder of Marlon Brando, Don Corleone. And I see really good comparisons between those two films in the sense of there's the big, brash American coming up there in his jodhpurs and his riding crop and his helmet, and he looks absolutely stunning when he gets up there and he tells the troops that, you know, you're going to do this, you know. No person ever won a war by dying for his country. He won a war by making the other enemy die for his country. Going on and on and on about that. And then you get this guy coming in from the really low level. He's an immigrant saying, "I believe in America." Excellent writer, Coppola, and he knows how to set things off. And he wanted to make this film like an opera. And his first choice for Don Corleone was Marlon Brando. And the studio hated it. Everybody hated the whole idea of having Brando in as Don Corleone because while back in the 1950s when he's making films like On the Waterfront, he was, and Streetcar Named Desire, he was a well-known talent. He was a phenomenal acting talent, a natural, just absolutely brilliant actor. But during the 1960s, he'd sort of gone off the rails a little bit, put on a bit of weight, drinking too much, been really difficult to handle, and a lot of the films that he'd been working on had been flops, so they didn't really want him at all. So Coppola, and the story is told in the particular book, they said you can only have Brando if he does an audition. And Coppola knew that Brando was never going to do an audition. He's Marlon Brando, greatest actor in the world. You want me. If you don't want me, go away. I'll go somewhere else. So Coppola, being the smart Italian lad that he was, got in contact with Brando and said, look, we want to do a bit of a makeup test. So what we thought we'd do is I'll give you a scene that I want you to work on, and I want you to get it so we get the lighting right so we can figure out, you know, what we have to do to your face or whatever. Because don't forget, Brando at this stage was probably early 40s, and he was playing Don Corleone, who was in his mid-70s, thereabouts. So he had to look a heck of a lot older. So Brando says, yeah, okay, turn up, bring your cameraman. So it was just Coppola and a cameraman and a sound guy. They all turned up, they set up, and Coppola's sitting on one side and he's looking at Brando. And Brando walks in wearing a dressing gown, as I gather he always basically did, and takes the dressing gown off, and he's got a decent set of clothes on for this particular character. And he's got a whole lot of stuff next to him, and he starts taking out this cotton wool, sticking it into his cheeks. And Coppola, and there's a note there about this saying, Coppola says that his whole face completely changed, his whole demeanour changed. And they filmed that, took it back to the executives, and the executives basically couldn't say no, because he'd done the audition and it was perfect. But if you think about all those other people that were in this particular film, Al Pacino, this was only his second film, Al Pacino. The only one that he'd made previously was A Panic in Needle Park, where he played a heroin addict extra in the background. Diane Keaton, this was only her second film, Lovers and Other Strangers. You have people like Robert Duvall, whose first role on screen, as far as I'm aware, was as Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird, and James Caan, who had made about 10 films, but none of them were terribly major. So this is an amazing piece of work, an amazing book that describes how this fantastic cinematic masterpiece came about. It's an excellent, excellent piece of work. I would heartily recommend that if you've got any interest at all in The Godfather, that you read this particular book. I know that there is a TV series called The Offer floating around, but it's on a streaming service that I don't have. That's, of course, the title there is taken from the line, we made him an offer he couldn't refuse. Think of all these lines that have come out of The Godfather, like that one, for example. You know, the iconic scenes of, you know, like the horse's head in the bed and, I'm flying out to see, Don Corleone likes to hear bad news immediately. All this stuff is just wonderful pieces of work in this particular film, which is why I love it so much. This is a good thing. Now, whether The Offer, this TV series, is based on this particular book or not, I don't know, because I haven't followed it up, because I haven't seen it at all, which I hope we'll try and get to by the end of the year. But this book, Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli, excellent stuff. I gave it 4 out of 5. It drags a little bit at times, so there's a lot of detail here, but there's also a heck of a lot of almost transcribed conversations that were going on during the development of the production. And it's just wonderful stuff, because Coppola basically wanted to make sure that he had records of everything, so that none of the people in the production company who were continually trying to get him sacked could actually sack him for doing something that he hadn't said he was going to do, or he said he was going to do it and then he didn't do it. He wanted to have a record of everything, so he had a court stenographer come in taking shorthand of all of the conversations. That's been transcribed, and there's a fair number of examples of it in this particular book. So if you want to know how, in the early 1970s, a big major film like The Godfather was made, this is the book for you. It's up there.
It sounds fascinating, Perry, but you're going to be shocked. I've never seen The Godfather.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. I really am quite shocked about that, because in my view, it is, as I say, I think The Godfather and Godfather Part 2, Because you've got to remember that the first Godfather was made purely thinking that was going to be the only one. And then a couple of years later, they made a follow-up, Godfather Part 2. Part 3 was much later, and that was sort of a tacked on. Godfather Part 3 is now being re-evaluated, and a lot of people are saying that it's a lot better than they thought it was originally. That's the case with a lot of films, and for whatever reason, some people just get a bit of a take against a particular film and they hate it. But I'm very shocked that you haven't seen this, David.
Oh, one of these days I'll see it.
Well, I do have it on DVD, so at some stage I might actually lend it to you.
Bring me the DVD, that sounds fine.
That's actually your task and homework for the next episode or an upcoming episode at some stage. I might get you to watch it. It's a long film, but it's just phenomenally good. But you need to see it with no distractions around because it's quite dark. It's there are scenes where it is out in the sunshine, but there's a lot of it filmed at night and in darkened rooms. So you need to be able to see it.
Watch on a decent sized screen.
And if you get the DVD, you've got the subtitles so you can understand it. So you won't have any problems with that, David. No.
All right, thank you.
Heartily recommend that one.
Indeed. All right. Well, the book sounds very interesting, even if I haven't seen the film as yet. All right. So I'll roll on to my first book, which is The Island by Adrian McKenty. Now, Adrian McKenty is an Irish writer who spent over 10 years living in Melbourne, although he's now based in the United States. And I read and enjoyed some of his thriller novels set during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, featuring his protagonist, a Catholic policeman called Sean Duffy. And apparently he's still writing this series, which is now up to 9 novels, with another 2 due to come out soon. So that looks interesting.
I'm looking forward to those.
Yeah. I've only read a few of the first ones, so I'll have to get into that. And I also see that he's written heaps of other novels, I didn't realise, including some science fiction YA novels, which I should certainly follow up on. A series called The Lighthouse. And he's won a swag of awards, including 3 Ned Kelly Awards, the Edgar Award, the International Thrillers Award, several others. Anyway. Apart from all, having said all that, I still didn't much like his one of his more recent books, The Chain, which was a bestseller, the one that really pulled him out of the doldrums, where he was deciding to give up writing. But he had a tremendous success with The Chain. But I personally didn't much like it. Anyway, this one is The Island has been getting great reviews, so I thought I should take a look anyway, and I'm glad that I did because it's a very good suspense-filled thriller set in Australia. So the basic story here is of a family who's visiting Australia from America. The father, Tom, is a surgeon in his mid-40s who's been invited to speak at a medical conference in Melbourne. He's got 2 teenage children from an earlier marriage who are called Owen and Olivia. And their mother died only a couple of years previously after a fall down a flight of stairs. And possibly in consequence of this, Owen, the younger sibling, has mentally retreated into a shell and is on several psychiatric medications. And Tom's new wife, Heather, is only in her early 20s, and she was a massage therapist who has no college education, and because of that she's despised and she's strongly resented by the 2 children, who don't accept her as their new mother. So I'm going to cut quite a lot of the story short. Now, they're probably going to give away a few spoilers, so be aware of that. But I'm going to cut a fair bit out. The basic crux of the story happens when the family set off on a short driving trip down the Mornington Peninsula during a break in Tom's conference. And they end up being taken on a ferry by a couple of rough-looking guys to a privately owned island just off the Victorian coast, because these guys tell them that there are heaps of koalas and other animals, Australian animals, to see there. But the family who own the island, the O'Neills, are ruled by a severe Irish-born matriarch just called Ma, and she hates visitors coming to the property. But nevertheless, Tom and a couple of Dutch tourists pay the blokes they've met several hundred dollars to ignore Ma's edicts for an afternoon and take them across on the ferry. So all is fine as the family drive around the island in their hired Porsche. Tom is seriously rich, so they hire a Porsche. They still haven't seen any koalas, but they're running late to return to the ferry at the time that it had been agreed. And so Tom speeds up on the road. And that's when they hit and kill a young woman riding a bicycle. They're out of range for their mobile phones and they can't call for help. And after the initial moments of shock, when they find that they can't revive this young woman, they panic, thinking of how rough the O'Neill family seem to be, and you know, they're sort of expecting to get pretty rough treatment by them. And Tom is somewhat concussed by the accident, and so Heather has to, she's forced to take charge. And they get the Porsche out of a ditch and they hide this young woman's body in bushes at the side of the road, hoping to be able to bluff their way back to the ferry and get back to the mainland, where they'll then report the accident. But their bluff doesn't succeed, and the family, the American family, then find themselves at the mercy of the angry O'Neills, who are determined to apply rough justice. And when the husband of the young woman they've killed turns up, things quickly turn violent and Tom is stabbed. Heather and the children of the two Dutch tourists manage to escape from the O'Neills, but where are they going to go? The island is small and the only way off is this ferry, which is under the complete control of the O'Neills. There seems to be no hope. Forced by adversity, Heather takes responsibility for the children and starts to draw on long-forgotten reserves of skill and resourcefulness. And this transformation of her and the way that the attitudes and behaviour of the two children are forced to change under this sort of pressure makes the story, I think, very compelling. But the author just keeps on ratcheting up the tension step by step as Heather, Olivia and Owen continue to evade the O'Neills, whose increasingly desperate and violent actions make it clear that they'll stop at nothing to prevent Heather from reporting them to the police. I do think that there were a couple of too-good-to-be-true things and coincidences which make their evasion of the bad guys just a little bit too easy for my taste, particularly in the closing scenes, but I think I'll forgive the author those. There's also an interesting afterword in which McKinty tells how the story in the novel is based on a real-life incident, what he calls his deliverance moment, where he almost but didn't quite hit a cyclist while driving with his family on a similar remote island in rural Australia. And he's telling the story to his agent, and the agent says, "No, you didn't miss the young woman. You hit her. That's your next book." And here it is. So, interesting, interesting. But yeah, it was very enjoyable. And really one of those you can't put it down books.
I think you and I did differ on our liking of The Chain, the previous novel. I quite liked it. I know that you said you weren't overly keen on it, by Andrew McKinty, but I liked it. My wife's read this book. She's a big fan of McKinty's. She's read all of his stuff that she can get a hold of. I don't think she's read the YA stuff as yet, but she's read his adult novels, including at least one or two of them set in Papua New Guinea, I believe.
Oh, interesting.
You don't get too many Western novels set in Papua New Guinea.
No.
So that would be interesting. He seems to be having himself two streams. He really likes the Sean Duffy stuff, but it just wasn't making any money. And as you said, he's got another couple of books to go. Hopefully, now that The Chain and The Island are doing quite well in the US, that a number of US readers will go back and have a look at his earlier stuff and have a look at these books about Sean Duffy set in The Troubles in Ireland. And it's a bit sad, isn't it, when you get a publisher says, "Oh no, we can't publish these books here because nobody's going to be interested in a series of novels set in Northern Ireland during the Troubles." Well, I would be. I am.
Yeah, that's right.
And I don't quite get that, because you know, it's an interesting and was a very, very difficult time, and you know, maybe some of the US readers need to be a little bit educated about what happens when two factions of one religion start going at each other like they did in Northern Ireland, and which is what, of course, they've done elsewhere in the world. So I think he's an excellent writer. I really like the way, as you say, he's able to ratchet up the tension and get the drama going. And you come away with it. Well, a lot of these things, sometimes there might be a few questions about how he actually got from this point to the end. But in general, you come out of it thinking, yeah, that was pretty good. And I would not be at all surprised from what you've said about this and what my wife said about it, that it certainly is going to get picked up for a film adaptation at some point or other.
Yeah, it'd be perfect for a film.
That's right. And good luck to him. I mean, he struggled for a long period of time, and as he said, he was about to give it away when The Chain did well, and this one's doing well, and he now seems to have settled into a good pattern of doing well with these particular novels, and a lot of people are paying attention to him. So, you know, people like Stephen King are paying attention to him now, and once you get the endorsement like Michael Rowbotham has by Stephen King, that you're going to fly in America, because...
Yeah, for sure.
Because King's got, you know, whether you like Stephen King or not in terms of his style, he's got a hell of a lot of followers, and a lot of people listen to the books that he talks about, because he does know when a good thriller works, and that's a major thing.
Sure.
So moving on for my next one, it's a novel. This is a book called Wild Place from 2021 by Christian White. Now, long-time listeners to this particular podcast might remember that you and I, David, discussed Christian White's second novel, The Wife and the Widow, which we both liked extremely well, which won the 2020 Ned Kellery Award for Best Novel. Now, this particular novel is his fourth. I hadn't realised that he'd got another one out in the middle, and I'd missed the third one, so this is the fourth one. Unfortunately, I don't find this one up to the standard of The Wife and the Widow, but this raises, to me, it raises a very interesting question about how I approach a novel that, in this sort of instance. Okay, so what we've got is an author that I've read who I really liked their second novel, and I come to read a subsequent novel and it's not up to the standard of the second one. Is my view of this particular novel under discussion now impacted by how much I liked the previous one of his I read, and therefore I'm marking this down because it doesn't come to that standard? Should I be taking a step back from that previous novel and looking at this book in situ on its own and say, well, how does this go on its own in comparison to other novels? If a reader was to come into this one completely fresh and this is the first one they read, how would they see it? That's the way that I should do it. Unfortunately, we're human and it's very difficult to actually put aside your feelings for the previous novel and not have those spill over into this particular one. So,
well, the thing is that you know that the writer can do better. That's the point, isn't it?
That is it, yes.
If you're just reading the book, like if you'd read the third book just out of the blue without having read anything else, you'd assess it on its merits. But yep. Because you don't know that the author is capable of more, but given that you do know that the author is capable of more, that's a reasonable approach to take, I think, yeah, to a subsequent book.
Anyway, well, look, I have tried to sort of take that step back off to one side and try to look at this book on its own and see how it comes to. But anyway, look, I'll give a bit of a rundown in terms of what the plot's about. So the book's set at the end of the 1980s, going from 89 into 1990, and it's set in a fictitious upmarket Melbourne suburb of Camp Hill, which is just near Frankston on the Mornington Peninsula. Second Mornington Peninsula novel that we've got for this particular episode. And it concerns the disappearance of a young woman who's just finished high school, a young woman by the name of Tracy Reed. The police, when they're informed of her going missing, aren't particularly interested in this at all. They just think of this as just a normal teenage runaway, blaming it partly on her parents' recent divorce, end of schooling worries, and, you know, maybe there's a boyfriend out there that the parent mother doesn't know about. Maybe she's just gone off with the boyfriend. But there are too many really inconsistencies in terms of the evidence left around and in the departure. And so a number of locals start getting together and scouring the area, putting up missing person posters, doing a bit of searching around. And one of them, Tom Witter, who's a teacher at the local high school, becomes a bit obsessed with the search for this particular girl. And the novel mostly follows him in terms of how he negotiates and what he does and goes around looking for things. Now, In the neighbourhood, there's a young guy who'd also gone to the Camp Hill High School, a guy by the name of Sean, and it comes out that Tracy had been in contact with him because Sean's the local drug dealer. He's the one selling marijuana to everybody, well, not everybody, but all to the students that want it, and possibly to a few of the parents as well. And then there's also Tom's eldest son, Marty, who has just, again, also finished high school and has decided to move out into a home of his own, and who seems to have been secretly in love with Tracy that nobody really knew anything about. Hovering around the edges also is Tracy's estranged father, a man who appears to be always on the very edge of violence about everything. He's just an angry man, and he's not happy with the way the divorce has gone. He's not happy about he's not seeing his daughter, and he's got to do whatever he possibly can to try to get her back. So there's certainly enough going on here, certainly enough diverse characters around, all sort of coming together. There's a bit of history in terms of Tom has been living in the area for quite some time. He's got a form of Tourette's, which gives him sort of twitchiness when he gets nervous. He's not one of these ones that swears at the drop of the hat continuously, but he's just got a twitch. And so some of the people that he'd used to know at school still make fun of him regarding that. But the author then starts going into a little bit of looking into, that idea of satanic panic that was around at one point, where the idea was that if kids were going to get into heavy metal music and be subjected to a number of so-called, and I put inverted quotes here, satanic images, that therefore they were going to become a Satanist and it was all going to go pear-shaped and they're all going to go off to the dogs. And there was also the idea, of course, that kids that started smoking marijuana, the next thing you know, they'd be shooting up heroin down the street and all this sort of stuff. So this is something that the author sort of starts getting into, and you start thinking about, were we that naive back then, back in the 90s, that we thought that this was going to be the case, that, you know, that heavy metal music was an entree to Satanism, and that, you know, smoking a bit of marijuana was suddenly going to make you a cocaine head? Don't really know. Well, maybe we were, and maybe it was there, but it's sort of, I don't know, it just seems to be a little bit a bit thin to me. Maybe, I don't know, I can't remember, but I hopefully we've moved on since then, that's for sure. Anyway, in the background of all of this in the suburb is a place called The Wild Place. That's called this by the people that live in the area, which is a sort of an area of wild natural reserve bordering onto the back of a number of the main houses in this particular story, because all of the people in this story live in this suburb in a couple of streets, and they're all know each other, and they're all sort of interrelated. And the author tries to make this particular wild place a bit more mysterious and scary than it really is. But I think he misses an opportunity here to maybe align it with some violent incidents in the past that he could have utilised to make this a little bit more mysterious, but he seems to pass that up. And so the wild place is just, I don't know, it's just a nature reserve in the back. And yes, it has something to do with the plot, which you could probably figure out if I kept on going, but I don't want to put any spoilers in here. But it's, really not... It doesn't have the tension that you really like to see in these things. And I sort of got the feeling that as I was going through this, it actually becomes a bit of a struggle to read, because you start thinking, I've seen these tired old crime tropes before. They seem to be the same sort of things. And you get to the end, and as you're going along, you think, oh, I'm pretty certain I know who one person is who's involved in all of this. And you're right. You figure that one out. And then right at the very end, in about the last half a dozen pages, suddenly there's somebody else who becomes majorly involved in Tracy's disappearance. And you really thought, it makes sense, but it seems to have been plucked out of midair somewhere. And, you know, you sort of, I don't know, I just felt that I was a bit disappointed in this particular book. Even trying to take a step back and look at it afresh as if I'd come across it just on its own. I still think it reads as a slightly tired novel. And given that this was, he's putting out one a year, maybe it would have been better if he'd held on for a bit longer and thought about this a bit more. So I was a bit disappointed. I only gave this one 2.8 out of 5. I know that rounds up to 3, but I was a bit disappointed in this one.
Yeah, which is a bit unfortunate.
Yeah.
It is. It is indeed. All right. Well, I probably won't go on and read that one then, even though I enjoyed his second book. What was his second book called? I forgot.
Well, his second book was The Wife and the Widow.
And this, The Wife and the Widow. Yes,
this is his fourth.
That was good.
Yeah, that was. Yeah, The Wife and the Widow was his second, and this is his fourth. So I've missed the first and the third. Ah, so, do I go back and read them again? Maybe I'll wait now until another book comes up where it's starting to get some good reviews, and then I might sort of come back and have a look at him again. But I was, there's only a certain amount of time you can spend with particular authors, and if they just go off the boil a bit, you sort of feel, should I come back in? Should I stay with them? Maybe I'll give this guy a rest for a little while.
Yeah, fair enough too. Yeah. All right. Okay, well, I'm going to talk about a debut novel, which is interesting. We have so many good crime writers in Australia, and there's all these new ones coming, popping up all over the place. Anyway, so this is The Daughters of Eve by Nina D. Campbell. Now, I was very, very nearly turned off this book by its first sentence, which I'll discuss in a minute. But I'm glad I persisted, because it turned out to be an excellent thriller examining some very serious issues in Australian society. So the book opens with a death. A prominent barrister, Thomas Griffith Jones, is shot dead in the car park of Sydney's Darlinghurst courthouse by a sniper. The barrister's just left court after he's been defending a man accused of killing his children by deliberately driving his car into water and leaving the kids to drown. This is clearly based on a well-known case in real life in Australia. Anyway, Detective Emilia Hart, who was also in the courtroom, sees Griffith Jones fall. And this is how the scene is described in the opening sentence of the book. This is the sentence which almost made me stop reading. He folded like a cheap suit after church on Sunday. Really? What does that even mean? How does a cheap suit fold after church?
No, it's thrown. That should have had a big red pencil through it.
Editor should have just crossed it out. Yeah, you know, it's one of those kill your darlings things. I think, you know, it should have been killed anyway. So whether the author was trying to sound like Raymond Chandler, I don't know. Anyway, an unpromising beginning, but I set that aside and I did keep going. There were a couple of other little flourishes like that, but not too many. It didn't impact me as much as that first sentence. So onto the story itself. So say Detective Emilia Hart is the first police officer on the scene, because she's only steps behind Griffith Jones when he's shot. And so she tries to staunch the flow of blood from his chest, and she's looking around very nervously for locations where the sniper could still be hiding. But because she's an eyewitness to the murder, Emilia feels that she's entitled to the lead role in the investigation. But this view isn't shared by her boss, Detective Chief Inspector Willoughby, and she's forced to work in collaboration with her rival in the station, Detective Mark Roberts, known to all as Robbo. And neither Robbo nor Hart is happy with this arrangement. It doesn't start out well, but they're slowly beginning to make it work when Hart's removed from the case, because there's been a complaint from the victim's influential widow after Hart had spoken briefly to the victim's daughter. So she's booted off to a much less important case, and she's seething as she investigates this case, which is the death of a man pulled from the river. He's presumed drowned after falling in drunk, until the autopsy reveals that he's been shot by rifle bullets, a compact pattern of 3 shots to the upper body, a pattern almost identical to that in Griffith Jones's body. So, is there a serial killer involved? If so, what's the connection between the victims? What's the motive? Hart gets together with Robbo again over the similarities of their cases, and Robbo becomes much more of an ally. Matters escalate rapidly as more men are shot by the sniper. And then a very similar case pops up in Melbourne. Now, Hart, who's served for a while in the Domestic Violence Division, is the first one to see the connections between the victims. They're all wife beaters or men who have sexually abused children. Griffith Jones, the first victim, was in court defending a man who almost certainly killed his own children in order to hurt his ex-wife. And then his client, that man himself, is also shot dead by a sniper. Not long afterwards, a website goes live carrying the manifesto of an organization calling itself the Daughters of Eve, claiming responsibility for the murders and calling on others to do likewise. No more, it is headed. The pages of history fail to record the atrocities visited upon women. It's time for men to learn what it is to walk in fear. And then it lists the victims of the shootings, including one victim's name, which is yet to be released to the public, so it suggests that the manifesto is indeed authentic. The government goes into full panic mode and deploys soldiers to patrol the streets of Australia's capital cities. And as Amelia Hart points out cynically and all too accurately, 14 men die, and it's terrorism. More than 50 women and children die every year, and what do we call that? Domestic violence, that's what we call it. And we're not mobilising the army to stop it. I won't give away the twist towards the end of the book, which I think I pretty much saw coming, but it was nevertheless very effective. Suffice it to say that when Hart and Robbo work out who is behind the Daughters of Eve, there are shattering revelations which shock them both. And then there's another twist, and another. So despite its awkward opening, I end up greatly liking this book, which has a great deal of importance to say about how appallingly badly some men treat women and children in this country and how easy it is for them to get away with it. And the novel treats these issues with an unwavering gaze. I thought it was actually very good.
Okay, yeah, it sounds like it is going to be an interesting book. And perfectly, the author's perfectly correct about the idea that there seems to be an uproar about some things, while others are completely and utterly pushed into the background and ignored, and they shouldn't be. It's just boggles the mind.
Yes.
But that's just the way a lot of time is driven by the media in terms of what the media sees as sensationalism. And as you say, they look at it as being domestic violence and therefore, not going to touch that, that's too hard. Well, somebody better get onto it sooner or later because it's a bloody epidemic in this country. Like it probably is in most other countries as well. And yes, you're going to have some comment, men get attacked as well. Not to the extent that the women do.
No way near.
Nor to the level of barbarity and violence that's undertaken. It's just shocking. It really is.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'll move very, very far away from that with my next book, and that is a book called The Inugami Curse, written in 1972 originally in Japan by Shishi Yokomizo. This has been translated into English by Yumiko Yamazaki and has been published. This is the second of Yokomizo's classic detective novels, Japanese detective novels that have been translated into English. I read and reviewed the first of these, The Honjin Murders, last year and really enjoyed it. That was a locked room mystery, which I always like because you always like seeing somebody working out a puzzle and having to come up with something new to basically to get there. This one's not as new in the sense of the way things work out, but it's... Well, I'll tell you a bit about it, and so it's basically, so you'll get an idea about where it comes from, and you'll see what sort of subgenre of crime novels and detective novels, if you like, this falls under. So don't forget, this is actually, in terms of the Japanese numbering, it's number 6 of the author's detective Kozuke Kindaichi series, but it's only the second one that's been translated into English. So it's always annoying when they do this. I just wish they'd just do it in order because, you know, that's the way they were published in Japan. Anyway, it's just purely a matter of who you can get to translate and which ones they like the best and which ones they're going to do. So I guess that's the way it goes. So just after the Second World War, he always puts this down as 1940 and then a dash, you know, so that we know it's in the 1940s, but we're not telling you when. But you can tell by the internal information in the novel that it's either 46 or 47. I'd say 46, although it could be the end of 45 because it's over the Christmas, sort of from October in, and Japanese soldiers are being repatriated back to Japan from Southeast Asia. So it could be 45, it could be 46, one of those two. Anyway, but so just after the Second World War, Sahai, the wealthy head of the Inugami clan, has died. And his author contacts Detective Kendechi, asking him to come immediately to the small provincial town where the clan is based. The lawyer's got this view that something bad is going to happen because he's sort of privy to the will, and he knows what's in the will, and he thinks that bad things are going to be happening because of this. So he asks Kendechi to turn up, but before he can actually get there, the lawyer's died. He's been murdered. So immediately Kendechi thinks, oh, well, he knew something, but he doesn't know what the lawyer particularly knew. So that's a bit of something going on in the background. So then Well, he's been told that some of these things are going to be happening, and that the lawyers had some predictions about what's going to be occurring, and so everybody thinks, oh well, we have to wait and listen to the will. But there's a clause in the will, and it means that they have to wait until a certain person has been repatriated back into Japan from the war. So they have to wait for it. Now, to give you the background, say he was this long-running head of a very influential business empire. He'd never married, he'd never acknowledged an heir, but he had three sons with three different mistresses. All of those three sons were taken into the business, but one of them is the one that they're waiting for to come back from the war, and so they have to sit there. Sahi was always also very fond of a young woman by the name of Tameo, who was the daughter of another couple who had acted as mentors and helped him when he was very young. So he got to know that family very, very well. And their daughter, Tameo, is a personal favourite of, or was a personal favourite of Sahi's. So they finally get the... A gentleman turns up who says that he is the missing son. The mother confirms that he is, but nobody can see his face because he says he's been badly disfigured in the war, and he wears a mask over his face. And the mask has been made to look like what he looked like prior to going to war. Anyway, they decide, right, okay, it is him, so that they can, the mothers vouch for him, so that they can read the will. And what it comes out is that the will is going to be left to Tameo if she decides to marry one of the three sons. Her choice, but she has to marry one. If she doesn't decide to marry any of them, or all they all predecease her, the money goes off somewhere else. It's a long sequence in the beginning of this particular book that goes into a lot of detail about what the will's doing, and it's frankly a little bit over the top. And so, of course, the three mothers, who all really dislike each other, and the three sons that are all there, are all keeping an eye on each other, and suddenly one of the sons is murdered, and then another one of the sons is murdered. And they're trying to work out who it is that's murdered these people. And so Kendechi's there dealing with the police, trying to work out who these murders are. This is one of those classic sort of country house arrangements, because it's, you know, everybody's staying in the one particular area. Like they're in a village, or they're in a large clan household compound. And things are going on between certain people and other people. Secrets are coming out, slowly working out why certain things are happening. It's all very complicated and rather difficult to follow. But the murders that have been committed have been done in a fairly brutal way, and have all been based on totems of the clan, which are the axe, the zither, which is a stringed instrument, and the chrysanthemum. You have to read it to basically get there. In many ways, this sort of describes this strange mixture of classic Western country house crime setup and Japanese violence and brutality, with decapitations a speciality, because there's a few decapitations in this. So it's interesting. If you like those classic Western country house or arrangements where everybody's stuck together and they can't get out and can't leave, and there's a murders going on, the classic Agatha Christie sort of style, you'll probably like this a lot. I'm not a big fan of it. I was interested enough. It takes ages to get going. It's about 60 pages before. It's just all this setup in terms of how all the family are related to each other, and then the will, and it just seems to drag and drag and drag until you get to the first murder, and then suddenly, oh, wow, we're off. And then it starts going, and you think, oh, thank God. Thank God there's a death. I mean, you were talking about the previous book, and you said, oh, you know, guy gets shot on the very first page. Get in there. You know, what's the expression? In media res? Get yes. right in the middle of the action and start it there and then tick it off and then have flashbacks if you want to. But if you take a long time to build up to it, by the time you get to it, you think, I don't know whether I'm interested in carrying on with this, because I don't know, I'm interested in any of these people. It's not a great book. It's not a great novel. It's interesting. I was interested to see how the Japanese do this particular style, and if you like it, that's a good thing to try and have a look at. Again, 3.2 out of 5. Not as good as the Honshin Murders, which I gave over 4 to. I really, really enjoyed that. But this one's not there. Not so much.
No, never mind. All right, now I've got yet another debut crime novel by an Australian author. And this is Wake by Shelley Burr. And this book opens with a woman called Mina McCreary, who's doing some grocery shopping in a small town in rural New South Wales, when she notices a stranger in the store who is paying her a great deal of attention. Now, strangers are rare in the town. It's out of the way, and very few travellers stop to buy things at this tiny general store. So Mina becomes very uncomfortable with this person's gaze at her, and she heads out from the store quickly, but he catches up with her in the street. And she's got a good idea of what it will be about. At best, it will be a journalist trying to get an interview for a story for the 20th anniversary of the mysterious abduction of Mina's twin sister, Evie, at the age of 10. At worst, it may be a random individual who's been reading about the case on the internet and wants to try out their pet theory, or worse still, accuse Mina herself of some part in the crime. Now, the case created a sensation at the time because Evie disappeared at night from the girl's shared bedroom, with no sign of a break-in, no fingerprints, no unusual tire marks around their remote property, and the case is still unsolved 20 years later. The stranger shadowing Minnow in the store, however, turns out to be neither a journalist nor an internet-inspired pest. His name is Lane Holland, and he says that he's a private investigator who's had success in cracking cold cases. In point of fact, he hopes to solve old cases in order to earn the rewards. There's a $2 million reward outstanding on the Evie McCreary case. Now, Mina initially harshly rejects his offer to look into the case, and she drives off in anger. Eventually, though, through the influence of a friend of hers who's also lost her sister, she's persuaded to work with Holland. And throughout the book, Mina's point of view alternates with that of Lane Holland, and we gradually start to understand that there are complexities to him. He's not just a bounty hunter, but there's something driving him to solve this particular case. Although he's made money this way in the past, he's now nearly broke and desperate, and he's deeply worried about the well-being of his much younger sister, Linny, who's about to start as a student at the ANU in Canberra. So there are two mysteries. Firstly, the original case as to what happened to Evie McCreary, and secondly, why it is that Lane is so emotionally invested in its solution. And the author handles the slow development of answers to these mysteries in a very assured way, I thought. A clever technique used in the book is the inclusion of excerpts from a Reddit-like forum of people obsessed with cold cases, and the arguments back and forth between the participants, coming up with exotic theories about who abducted Evie and, more importantly, how. Now, Evie's father and the residential farm manager were not suspected because they could prove that they were both away from home at the time of the disappearance on separate business trips to Sydney and Adelaide. Many posters on this forum therefore accuse Mina's mother or the wife of the fire manager, or even Mina herself, though of course she was only 10 years old at the time. The closing chapters of the book go in an unexpected direction and lead to a shattering conclusion, which I certainly didn't see coming. So I thought this was a very impressive debut novel. The book is deeply engaging, one of those books where you're very reluctant to put it down. And even when you finished it, you think about it for quite a while afterwards. The characters are really well drawn and they have considerable depth, and the confident depiction of the remote rural areas and the rural life of Australia is interesting in itself. So, yeah, I'll be very interested to read anything else that Shelley Burr happens to write. Definitely recommend it.
Okay, I've been seeing it around a fair bit and seeing some reviews of it, and it's getting a bit of buzz about this particular book. So it'll be interesting. Was that from this year or last year?
This year, I think, yeah.
Okay, so it'll be interesting to see where it pops up on any of the...
on the Nicalis or whatever.
Or the Davits or one of those next year. Yeah, that'll be interesting to see what happens to that. So we'll keep an eye out with that one. And if it wins an award, I'll have to find time to read it, and then we can reevaluate and see whether I agree with you, David. But it does sound interesting. So
yeah, it is good.
I said earlier on in this particular episode that we were going to be covering different parts of crime fiction, and I started off with a non-fiction treatment of how a certain movie came about. Then we hit a couple of novels, and now I'm going to start dealing with a few TV series that I've been watching lately. And there's been a lot of them that I've been watching. I've really enjoyed I'm two seasons through a show on Netflix called Ozark, which I'm really enjoying. It's based on a guy who's a money launderer for a Mexican drug cartel, and he moves to the Ozark region to start up a whole lot of new businesses to launder a lot more money. The interesting thing about him is that he's like a suburban accountant. And he just has to be, he's very good at laundering money, but he's got a wife and a couple of kids. And they all end up getting involved as well. But it's very interesting to see a crime series told from the point of view of the perpetrator, as opposed to the police. And it's also interesting to see with the British TV series Line of Duty, seeing the anti-corruption forces having a look at the... looking at corrupt police as well as criminals as well, and the criminals they associate with. So if you get a chance to see either Ozark or Line of Duty, I think the earlier seasons of Line of Duty have now dropped off Netflix, so you'd have to go hunting around for them. Ozark is still there. That's four seasons, I believe, and I'm two seasons through it. I couldn't tell you how many seasons there are of Line of Duty, but I think I've watched five of them. So they're all pretty good. But one of the other ones, the one that I wanted to particularly talk about here, was the first season of a new series called Slow Horses. This is a sort of an espionage drama on Apple TV. And it's based on the Mick Herron series or novel of the same name. And he has a series which follows the exploits of a group of British spies working in Slough House, S-L-O-U-G-H, House. And everybody else, of course, calls it Slow House. Because while the people that work in Slough House are actually ostensibly still members of the British intelligence services, these are the ones that are stuffed up. They've done the weird things like leaving a secret file on the train when they shouldn't have, or like one of the main characters in this particular series, who has the name River Cartwright, played by Jack Loudon, who's an actor that you need to keep an eye on, I think, who's in Wolf Hall and the film Dunkirk. He failed a large-scale, real-world simulation of a... of the capture of a lone terrorist bomber. Ended up following the wrong guy, realising too late that he'd got the wrong guy, went after the right guy, but theoretically it was too late, boom, according to the simulation. And they estimated that, he lost 50, 100 people died in this explosion that he caused. Well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Anyway, so he's been relegated to this particular offshoot of the service over at Slough House. Slough House is run by a gentleman who is played in this particular series by Gary Oldman. And this gentleman's name is Jackson Lamb. And Jackson Lamb is, he's not George Smiley, not by any stretch of the imagination. However, he has a lot of Smiley's cunning and rat cunning. But in this case, Oldman's the other end of the scale, where George Smiley was, you know, polite, erudite, intelligent, incisive, analytical. Oldman is also incisive, intelligent, analytical, but he's also sweary, lazy, he's a boozer, he farts all the time, and he's basically a total pain in the ass to everybody. He hates everybody. He's just there to see out his time, and he doesn't want any of the guys working for him doing anything to rock the boat at all. So when he finds out that a couple of them are keeping an eye on an intelligence situation that's come up, where a right-wing British group calling themselves the Sons of Albion have kidnapped a young Pakistani man and have threatened to behead him live on the internet, he's a little bit annoyed about this. But Cartwright and the slow horses of Slough House are tracking this and sort of doing their own little bit and working their way into the investigation against the specific wishes of their betters at HQ. The betters here are the ones that have, yes, they do keep an eye on Gary Oldman, and yes, they feed him things every now and again, but really don't want him undertaking any projects at all. All they want him to do is get their people to look through crappy old bits of documents. You know, if they find stuff, great. If they don't, who cares? We can't get rid of you because you're tenured or you're in the organisation and we can't afford to get rid of you. So we'll keep paying you, but we don't want you to do anything. But in this instance, they do things, and it comes across as real. It's just a wonderful piece of work. I mean, Gary Oldman is just astounding in this role. He chews everything, the scenery, everybody up. He's a terrible person, but you actually get to the point where you actually think he's doing a really good, damn good job. And even though he basically swears at his underlings and tells them they're useless, you sort of get the feeling that he actually does like them a little bit, but he's trying the best he possibly can not to let them know that. And so I can hardly recommend this one. There's 6 episodes in the first season. The second season has finished filming and will be broadcast later this year. And I read this morning that it has been renewed for seasons 3 and 4. Now, theoretically, they're going to be following the books in this particular series by Mick Herron. And I've read the first book that this one was based on, and I loved it. I thought it was spectacular. I reviewed it on the podcast last year. And I'm going to have to make sure that I read the next one, Dead Lions, before the next season of this is broadcast. And it'll be back and around available for me to see when I get back from my holiday later in the year. And I gave this one 4.4 out of 5. I really enjoyed this series, David. It was wonderful. Have you had a chance to catch it?
I concur. I think it's terrific. I really, really like it. And now I haven't read the book, so I have to now go and find the book and the other books by Mick Herron. But Gary Oldman is just disgusting. He's brilliant.
He is just,
absolutely brilliant.
He is just totally disgusting, but he is just so good. And the more I think about it, he is that other end of the spectrum from George Smiley, except that they've got the commonality of the wit and intelligence. It's just how they utilise it that makes it completely different.
Yeah. I can't wait for the next season either. My wife and I both watched it and both enjoyed it a lot. So I'm really looking forward to the next season.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to talk about a TV series too. And this is called The Outlaws, and it's on Amazon Prime, which I subscribe to, the only streaming service I do subscribe to at the moment. Now, The Outlaws is directed and part written by Stephen Merchant, who you'll probably recall as the tall, lanky guy from the original British version of The Office. Now, he's also one of the cast of this show, The Outlaws, alongside veteran US actor Christopher Walken. Now, the concept is of a group of seven strangers who've all done something wrong. They've been nobbed for some sort of crime. They've been placed in a mandatory community service program in the city of Bristol in lieu of going to prison for various crimes. Now, as they half-heartedly try to clean up an old heritage building in Bristol, the group interact with each other, of course, and they get involved with each other's concerns, often very reluctantly. And it's very funny at times. I think you could say that Slow Horses is a thriller show with moments of very great humour. This is a comedy show with moments of quite great tension. So it's just kind of the opposite balance to that. We have this young half-Pakistani character, Rani, who's played by Rianne Barreto, and she's been caught shoplifting, and that's why she's in this program. And there's a young man called Christian, who's played by Gamba Cole, and he's a young black man serving time for some sort of drug offence. And then we have Christopher Walken, who's great as this slightly doddery ex-convict. Now, also in the group, we have an angry white conservative who's about to lose his family business, a famous TikTok celebrity with anger management issues, a disgruntled middle-aged activist who's been shot for towing away a police recruitment van, with police still inside, and a gangly, unsuccessful solicitor who's in trouble for ramming a police car while trying to escape from being charged with offending public morality. So that's the scenario. And this plot starts to build. Young half-Pakistani Rani, who's played by Rianne Barreto, as I've said, befriends Christian. And he's trying to keep his sister out of the hands of a drug-dealing gang, but he's forced by them to commit a burglary to steal the contact phone of a rival drug group. So Christian, wearing a mask and carrying a gun he's been given by the leader of the drug-dealing gang, breaks into the house of the rival gang and forces them to show him where the phone with their list of customers' numbers is stashed. And it's lying on top of a gym bag stuffed with thousands of pounds in cash. So acting on an impulse, he takes both the phone and the bag of money and runs. Now, Christian hands over the stolen phone to the drug dealer, but he doesn't mention the money, which he stashes in the ceiling of the heritage building that the community service workers have been cleaning up. Now, he's planning to take the money and speedily move out of Bristol with his sister before he's found out. But of course, things don't work out as he planned them. I won't say any more, but all the cast are great. But I particularly loved the role played by Christopher Walken. Such a great actor anyway. But in this is the serial con man, and he's currently living, as part of his release, he's been told he has to live with his daughter and her kids, much to her disgust. So in the very first episode, she's tutoring her five-year-old daughter and her teenage son. "Your grandpa is a lying, thieving, selfish old bastard. What is he?" "Grandpa is a lying, thieving, selfish old bastard," repeats the young girl dutifully. "And he is too." So we're enjoying this greatly. We're currently halfway through the second season. The show's got moments of real tension, but it's got lots of really good humour, as you'd expect from Stephen Merchant. Highly recommended. Well worth watching.
Well, another one of the shows that's on at the moment, which has got a bit of a comedy and crime mixture, is Only Murders in the Building, starring Steve Martin and Martin Short and Selena Gomez, which is on Disney Plus, is it? I think so. Not sure. Anyway, Only Murders in the Building. These three residents of this particular apartment building in New York decide to investigate the death of one of the residents and start their own true crime podcast. And I really liked, in the first season, I really liked the work of Steve Martin and Martin Short. Steve Martin is not necessarily somebody that I've liked all along. I've found some of his work good and some just to be, you know, very ordinary and just trying to force the comedy. In this one, he doesn't seem to have to do that. He's actually making fun of his own celebrity in a lot of ways. Martin Short just chews the scenery and he's fantastic. In the first season, Selena Gomez was completely one note. There was just nothing with it at all, and I couldn't work out what she was doing. But look, I still like the first season. She's a lot better in the second one. She seems to have loosened up a heck of a lot more. But the other two are still going fantastically well. And so that if you're looking for a little bit of a comedy with a little bit of crime or a little bit of drama thrown into it, a bit like The Outlaws. The only murders in the building are only 30 minutes an episode. And so the way we do it is we have a tendency to watch something which is a little bit more traumatic, like Ozark, watch an episode of that, and then watch 30 minutes of Only Murders in the Building. It's sort of like having main course and dessert, and you finish off feeling, oh yeah, that's okay, but you're still seeing a good drama at the beginning, but you're seeing a bit of a light comedy at the end and still sort of carrying on. So that's useful. Sometimes, like the next thing that I'm going to be talking about, you really do need that little bit of light relief at the end of an episode, because sometimes they can become a little bit on the harrowing side. This TV series that I'm going to be talking about now is actually a mini-series of 8 episodes from this year, and it's called The Staircase. The two main characters are played by Colin Firth and Toni Collette. So you can understand you've got some fairly high-class actors working here. And this is an excellent crime drama based on a true crime story. On the 9th of December 2001, writer and would-be politician Michael Peterson, played by Colin Firth, calls 911 in Durham, North Carolina in the US to report that his wife Kathleen, who's played by Toni Collette, has fallen down the stairs and is unconscious. Interesting that you had earlier on in this particular episode somebody dying for falling down the stairs. So anyway, so Kathleen's at the bottom of the stairs and unconscious. But by the time the emergency services arrive, she's died. And it all looks like a tragic accident because you can see the stairs and she just tumbles down the stairs and hits her head and looks bad. But almost immediately, the local police decide it was anything but an accident and charge Michael with her murder. Now, this series, as I said, based on this particular true story, then follows the crime's investigation. And I'm not going to give you away any spoilers here because it's a completely true story. You need to look it up and read the whole thing. You're not dealing with the story because that's well known. You're dealing with how the filmmakers and the storytellers are presenting this and the implications of what it actually tells about the way criminal services work around particular crimes and what people are like. Anyway, so the series follows the crime's investigation, the trial. By the end of the first episode, he's actually indicted by a grand jury and he has to stand trial. His trial, his conviction for murder, his time in prison, his retrial, because they had to have a retrial because they found out that one of the key witnesses for the prosecution basically lied about his level of experience in terms of blood splatter analysis, and the final outcome of the whole affair. Now, added to this, you might think, oh, well, that's just a standard sort of flow going along all the way right through. Added to this, in early 2001, or 2002, just not long, a few month or two after the particular murder had occurred, a French documentary team of filmmakers received permission to follow the case as they've decided that they want to do their next piece on an examination of the US legal system, and they want to examine it in some depth. And this looks like the case for them to get to. So in some senses, this particular story, The Staircase, is a fictionalisation of that original documentary. Now, the interesting thing is that original documentary is also available at the moment on one of the other streaming services. This one is on Foxtel, so it's probably also on Binge, on one of those. I believe that the original French documentary is on Netflix. So you can watch this fictionalisation and then watch the documentary, or the other way around if you like, just to see how it goes. Now, this particular fictionalisation, this miniseries, is really well produced. They've done a lot of excellent work. They've got some excellent actors all the way right across the board, filling in all the different parts. You've got one of the French film editors is Juliette Binoche. I think it's still Juliette. Anyway, she's a major French actress, and she's in this, so that adds another level of credibility. But you get more and more information about the background of the particular characters. You find out that Kathleen was working for Nortel, and a major Canadian telecommunications company that basically went belly up in the early 2000s, because, and this is at a time when things were going really, really bad. You find out that Michael's got a private life that is not what he likes people to know anything about. So basically he's bisexual. He says that he doesn't have affairs with men. He has sexual encounters with them. But that adds another level of frisson to the whole particular story. The series jumps backwards and forwards, so you're getting some things from one time, some things from another. You have to pay attention to what's going on. Early on, they give a dramatized version of Michael's view of what happened, that she falls down the stairs and dies by hitting her head, slipping and hitting her head a couple of times. And so there's basically the blood spatter on the wall, and you see that she's there, and by the time he gets there, she's almost dead, and then she dies. Then, later on, after the trial, there's a flashback to a point where they're having an argument, and he basically gets something and beats her to death with it. And again, you get exactly the same blood spatter as you had previously. And then on another occasion, there's another opportunity for another version of what happened. And that's been an intervention of basically a bat who was in the roof and comes in and claws her. That's why she falls. She doesn't slip, but she falls. So you've got a very, very interestingly well-made piece of work. It's complicated. It's harrowing. Do I know whether he did it or not? I went through phases. No, he didn't do this. And then I thought, yeah, he did do this. And then I'm not sure whether he did do this. And so I got to the end and I thought, actually, I don't know. And really, I don't care, because it was so well done. You don't get the miniseries leaning one way or the other. They provide the whole full picture of what happened, and they just basically leave it up to you to figure it out. And I was happy with that. I came away with that. Oh, this is highly recommended in my view. I gave this 4.5 out of 5, so it's pretty high, and it'll be very high in my end of year roundup. Really enjoyed this, but it is a bit harrowing for some people. And you have to pay attention. You can't just sort of drift in and drift out. It's the series demands that you watch every bit of it so that you know what's going on. Because if you take your eye off it, you won't realise that suddenly you're back in 2001 instead of in 2015. And why is he out when suddenly over there he was in jail 5 minutes ago? Now he's wandering around a video store or DVD store. What's going on? You have to basically pay attention. But highly recommended. Highly recommended.
Sounds good. Mm. I'm going to finish off by talking briefly about the show I'm going to call Capital Crimes. Recently I've been glued to the screen watching many hours of a terrific new television series which features a lead character with a fatal flaw. It's about the unbridled lust for power, overweening ambition, blatant nepotism, corruption, secret plotting, suspense, intimidation, and ultimately the cultivation of outright violence. And so far the bad guy's been winning, but the good guys are intent on bringing this nefarious character down and are slowly building a case against him by careful detective work, skillful interrogation, and a patient determination of the facts. Succession? No. This series is called The Public Hearings of the Select Committee to Investigate the January 6th Attack on the United States Capitol. Bit of a mouthful. You'd think they'd give it a much snappier name like Capital Crimes, but who am I to judge? And so far, I've watched every minute of it. You've probably read various summaries of it, but I'd seriously recommend that you watch it all. I'll put a link in the show notes. I just think they're doing a brilliant job of making the case that certain individual, Donald J. Trump, should never be allowed anywhere near the levels of power ever again. But whether they'll stop him is an unresolved question. With the vice chair of the committee, Liz Cheney, losing her seat in Wyoming, it's not looking so good.
For a moment there, I thought you were talking about our recent prime minister who's having a bit of trouble with similar sorts of things, yes. Sort of possible abuses of power and deception and detective work being undertaken. So I thought, hang on, is he talking about Capitol Crimes? Is he talking about Canberra? No, you're actually talking about Washington. So that's...
And the Capitol building, yeah.
That's interesting. Yep. Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's well worth watching. I'll put a link in the show notes.
What's that on? Is that...
It's on... You go to the website and
oh, okay.
I think they're all on YouTube, but there's a website link I'll give which gives a link to all the hearings, which I think there have been 6 or 7 so far.
Yeah,
but they all run for a couple of hours each. But it's...
So it's a commitment, it's riveting.
It's gripping.
Yeah. And it's very interesting to watch the way they do things and how they... in the US and how they do things in out in the open, in public, and they have the open hearings and, you know, you're getting all this stuff and you're thinking, my God. Interesting to watch. So anyway, I think really what it comes down to, David, is there is a shedload of really good television around out there at the moment. There's a lot of work being put into some really good TV series. And I'm enjoying a lot of the stuff that I'm watching. I really don't review stuff that I don't like because can't be bothered because I basically might get 1 or 2 episodes in and then, no, I'm not going to stay with this. So I'm not going anywhere that I'm really particularly interested in unless somebody has said you have to stick with it. If I'm not finding that somebody's told me that, I'm just willing to give it up and move on to some other things because there's a heck of a lot out there and I'm a long way behind. I mean, people have been telling me for years, for example, that Better Call Saul, the sort of prequel to Breaking Bad, which is just finished after 7 seasons, is fantastic. But I haven't watched any of it. So that's... You know, another 70 hours of my life I've got to try it for.
life is too short.
It's all good that there's all these things around out there that are good to watch and just provide a lot of interest. And so hopefully we've given some people a few pointers about where they should...
Spend their time.
Yep.
All right, well, I think we might leave it there, Perry. And
okay.
I hope your trip goes well. And
all right, thank
we'll
you very
look
much.
Forward to seeing you when you come back.
Yes, we'll do. Thank you, David.
Thanks for that, Perry. We'll look forward to you being back in Australia and back on the podcast. I'll be by myself here next episode 2, but I'll be interviewing a couple of people, I think, or at least one. And I'll leave that as a surprise for that particular episode. Before I go, a reminder that we do have a website at twochairs.website, and you'll find all of our episodes there, together with a comprehensive set of indexes to all the books, movies, and television shows that we've discussed. So if you want to see what Perry and I have said about a particular book or whatever, you can look it up there and you'll get a link to the relevant episode. That's all for now. I'll see you in 3 weeks' time. Bye.